Welcome to the Autism Mom MD podcast, where we discuss empowerment, growth, and inclusion for individuals with autism. And now your host, Dr. Carol Baltazar.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. B. Welcome to the Autism Mom MD podcast. This episode highlights the longest relationship, which is the sibling relationship. My guest today is Carolyn Chen. Carolyn was a sibling support coordinator for the Maryland Developmental Disabilities Council, where she organized the largest statewide conference in 2015 and 2019 for siblings of individuals with developmental disabilities. She is a younger sister by 2 years to Jennifer, who is learning disabled and is her inspiration to continually strive to be her best self. Carolyn began her career in management consulting in New York and is currently a legislative analyst for the Montgomery County Council in Maryland, where she manages grants for nonprofit organizations. Please join me in welcoming Carolyn Chen. Hi, Carolyn.
Hello, Dr. B. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for joining me on my podcast today.
Thank you for having me. This is more than an honor.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your family?
Yeah, my name's Carolyn. I'm 42 years old. I'm Taiwanese American. I'm from actually born in Minnesota. My sister was born in Kansas, and my brother was born in Maryland. So I'm the middle child. Mm-hmm. My parents have a typical immigration story from Taiwan to come to Kansas and Missouri to get their PhDs. And then we settled down in Montgomery County in Maryland since I was in maybe third grade. One, because of the jobs that were there, the government mm-hmm. jobs that were there. And also Montgomery County is known for its very structured and successful benefits for people with disabilities.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's dive right into the questions.
Sure.
What does being a sibling mean to you?
That's definitely... Well, first, let's start off that I never even considered myself a sibling forever until someone told me there's this thing called a sibling where where you are the neurotypical sibling of a developmentally disabled individual. I didn't know that until 2014 when I started working. When I had come back to Maryland to work with my sister and her life plans. But now my sibling means so much more. So it probably just started off as being like, I was the invisible kid to my family growing up. I had to be perfect, have no problems, not bother anyone. And because there was so much that needed to be done with my sister. And I would say now the definition of sibling means that I am lucky that I'm constantly inspired and have almost like an in to being a really good person the more that I learn from my sister. And so now it's super... I wear it with a badge of honor now that I'm a sibling, and that's where the passion I think comes from to make sure that other siblings get to this point. They move from the invisibility and the resentments and get to a point where they're understanding kind of this superpower of being a sibling.
Mm-hmm. I love that description. I mean, it's definitely a superpower.
Yes.
When were you aware that Jennifer has a developmental disability?
So Asian Americans in general, and I'm Taiwanese American, don't ever mention this word. I think someone might have told me that there isn't an actual translatable word in Chinese. So I was never specifically told that because there was never that term. Mm-hmm. Back, so my sister is what, 44? So back then we still use the word retardation. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think I knew what developmental disability was till much later in my life, but I do remember very, very, very specific moment, which was I was at a playground I was in second grade, and my father pointed to my sister across the playground and said, "Do you notice your sister's like left arm doesn't move when she walks?" And I was like, "Oh, okay." And he's like, "Do you see how you walk and both your arms swing?" And I said, "Yes." And he goes, "So your sister, during her birth, her brain was damaged during her birth. So we have to work on getting her brain right so that both arms, you know, can swing." Mm-hmm. And that's about it. I just knew, oh, okay, great. And then when my sister had went through physical therapy and both of her arms swing, that was about it. I thought, okay, she's cured.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. That was second grade.
So, you know, that's a great segue into the next question that I was going to ask you. What was it like growing up with Jennifer then? And let's talk about like the elementary through high school years.
It was very difficult, super confusing. And I did not have a relationship with my sister as a sister. It was a constant competition of her competing with me. So me and my sister are 2 years apart. My brother didn't come till 10, 12 years later. So, you know, our early years in elementary and middle school were just the two of us, and very close in age. We did share a room when we were little. So when we're small, so I'd say like prior to first grade, there was, you know, no indication of any differences between us, and we were sisters. We have really great pictures of us, like where it was really clear, you know, nothing was wrong. And then I would say once she started seeing the progression difference in pace in education or socialization, then it became a competition between the two of us. And really strangely, later in my life, like in my 20s, I was cleaning out files for my father, and I saw a psychiatrist evaluation of my sister and me when we were like six. Yeah, like a six. And I read it like 20 years later. And it says in there that my sister will consistently be increasingly more jealous as we get older, because I was looking like a social butterfly to her, and that it was going to be an issue. And it was, I would say, my entire life. So through K through 12, it's not that we competed. She didn't like me. So she didn't speak to me. She competed with me. And I was always like, there's no competition. I'm not trying to compete with you. Most of our sibling relationship growing up was me defending her, standing up for her in public or with people at school when we went to the same school, and then her hating me for it. And that's all I remember probably all through high school.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't remember anything like really positive. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. Was it hard to find true friends, you think, because some kids just weren't accepting of your sister's disability?
I think we come from the generation of silence. So you just didn't say anything. You know, my family didn't say anything. Mm-hmm. We didn't say anything. It wasn't like we were hiding her in my house. It was more of, we were just not mentioning it, because not just, this is true of any family that understands developmental disability, but especially for Asian American culture and community, it's a flaw. It's a failure of some point of the family to have a child that is not perfect. And so I think with then, we always had like a black X, you know, like a little X on us whenever we went somewhere, because it was like asking questions about me or my brother and then kind of forgetting about my sister, you know. So that's what I remember in terms of where she was in our family. It was more of like, let's just kind of like treat her like everything's fine and ignore everything else.
I'd agree with you that there definitely is a stigma in the Asian American community, and you know, that can lead to delays and even, you know, getting diagnosis and yes. intervention. So, but yeah, we tend, I just had a conversation earlier about the stigma and the cultural biases that we have. And it can be a strength and a weakness, right? It's the strength that, oh yes, you know, we'll just, you know, work through our problems. We'll persevere. We'll do our best to get through the adversity. But at the same time, it's like we hide it. And then we don't know. I mean, there could be other resources out there that could help propel the person forward, the whole family forward, exactly. In a more positive way.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And I would also, you know, also note that, you know, the critical nature of how we are as a culture, as well as how people, parents are when you have a child with disability, that also just, that evolves and matures over time and decades too. So the expectation that a parent who has had no experience with individual disabilities, they aren't a sibling, you know, they mm-hmm. don't have someone in the family, the expectation that they would, that you as a parent would know what to do and how to foster that is unrealistic. And mm-hmm. so I appreciate when we can move away from that and say, you know, yes, there is a stigma. And if we didn't have it, this would happen. But on the other hand, at least for my family journey, I gave my parents like more of like this permission, like leeway, like, hey, you did the best you could and it was pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. And anything that comes out of that is not something to be judged anymore. You know, right. It's more like, this is who we are.
Right.
This is who
right.
we are. And so I find that to be really hard when you're in the middle of it.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Right.
when you're in the middle of like, you know, fighting with your sister. But yeah.
Did you have any friends who had siblings with autism or other intellectual developmental disabilities who could relate with you?
Absolutely not. Not one. Mm. Not one. I didn't even know that there is that's something we could have in common. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're ignoring the sibling with developmental disabilities in the family, you're definitely ignoring that you have a sister with developmental disabilities, mm-hmm. which means it's not something you advertise in your first conversations of being your friend.
Yeah.
I would say it's very much like a lot of people might say, oh, I didn't know you had a sister. You know, this is the one in high school. Because right. you like never talk about it, right? And I'm like, right. oh, and I never knew that I never talk about her. But it was that subconscious of like, you know, it wasn't an issue because I did my own thing. I left the house, you know, it didn't affect my K through 12, you know, like my, especially in high school and junior high, it didn't affect it. So I never sought that kind of support because I didn't know I needed it.
Interesting.
And so yeah. I think what was really groundbreaking for me when I heard there's this thing called sibling, kind of blew my mind, you know, mm-hmm. it blew my mind of like, all I needed to know was that it's a thing. Like, that's it. I didn't even need to know detail. It was like, all of us have the same shared experience and there's no way we could have found each other if you didn't have like a t-shirt, you know? So, uh-huh, right. So I think what's great now is now that this is an actual, you know, support group or, you know, an actual audience of people to cater to, people are really opening up to that. And the support and knowing that is tremendous. So mm-hmm. there's a huge difference. But me, myself personally, I had not one person.
Hmm. Did you experience jealousy or resentment towards your sister because your parents had to devote more time to take care of her?
I've thought about this when you sent over the questions, and I really didn't, because she experienced all the jealousy and resentment between the sibling relationship for me. It was all housed in her. And on top of it, I'd say, there was nothing to be jealous about. It was more of like, I want my sister to be happy. And so my parents are telling me to be completely perfect So let me try to do that. And then when I couldn't do that anymore, this is in high school, then you rebel, right? And you say, I'm out. You know, like I'm out from being perfect anymore. But that really had nothing to do with my sister entirely. It was more of just teenage rebel, Asian American culture oppression, you know, mm-hmm, like perfectionism, mm-hmm. kind of all wrapped up in one, you know?
Right, right. Well, I get it. And I try to find that balance too with my own kids.
Yes.
Because as you know, my oldest, Ray, he's in college now, but he has two younger siblings in high school and middle school. And we pretty much try to divide things up. So, you know, it is hard. And like I said, I did feel guilty, especially when they were all much younger, because mm-hmm. I felt like for my younger two, it was, you know, a lot of the time was spent, oh, you know, we got to go to your brother's speech language pathologist appointment, or we got to go to Kennedy Krieger right now. So their time with me was more so like sitting in a waiting room. Mm-hmm. And I felt so bad that, you know, they had to kind of like become more independent much more mm-hmm. quickly. And I'm sure you can relate to this.
Yeah.
And you know, they had to study more in the sense that, oh, okay, you know, that way they didn't have as many questions to ask mm-hmm. me or my husband mm-hmm. And kind of just, you know, I think, you know, start chores earlier. I think that, like, those kinds of things, maybe they had some resentment, you know, before, but until probably, you know, as my son got older, and definitely had more, developed more skills and strategies, it got better where, you know, they could, you know, divide up all the chores. And because I really wanted to make sure that Ray also was being, you know, I was preparing him to live independently. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's, you know, that was the hard part, I think, with my kids. So I guess that's the next question I have for you. Mm-hmm. Did you understand what your parents were going through?
No.
When you were younger?
Mm-hmm. No. And again, to understand, like listening to you, also just highlights the differences in just a generation of what is required of parents. So most parents these days do talk about, you know, having to take all their kids to all the appointments, you know, mm-hmm. and sitting in the waiting room. What if you didn't have any of those appointments, right? And so mm-hmm. that's my sister, you know, where it was like, could she have benefited for that? Of course. Did we know about them? No. You know, is there, mm-hmm. was there a way that we would have, you know, created this whole network of different supports? Maybe. But when you're really trying to, you know, really trying to just be on the, you know, down low about your family, you don't really put yourself out there. And so my experience is an enormous amount of time of my parents with my sister, but also with me, just on completely different expectations. You know, but we were both held to an extremely high standard mm-hmm. of, you know, of academic, yeah. which in terms is was not the right way to go with my sister, because that doesn't, then you lose, and this isn't just not her, this is Asian American culture in general. It's like, you lose the socialization, you lose the social skills and the awareness, emotional intelligence, when you focus so much on academics. So we had the same standard, my sister and I, we were, you know, punished when we didn't meet that standard. And so I think it was more of, you know, an expectation that, hey, if you just do everything right, Carolyn, then there's more time for your sister and she needs more time. You know, it was more like that.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to like, you know, we don't spend any time with you. That's how I took it. That's how I remember it. I don't remember it as like, you know, that I wasn't spending time with them. It was more of like the more that I don't, the more invisible I am, then the better it is for family. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was like everything was just absolutely perfect.
right
until high school.
I know, and I like I said, I think my kids, my younger two, kind of feel that way sometimes too. Mm-hmm. Because they just don't want to be like, oh, I didn't want to bother you, mom. I know you already have a lot on your plate.
Right.
You know, so there's a lot of guilt for a parent when you feel like, oh, you know, so then I think for our listeners out there, I mean, I guess that there are ways to try to, have that one-on-one time. Sometimes it can be difficult, but even just like I would, take them, like, you know, each one, not all together, mm-hmm. like, to the grocery store. Mm-hmm. I'll say for like my middle son, I'd say like, hey, I got to run some errands. You want to come with me? Mm-hmm. And even that car ride mm-hmm. could just be time to just, you know, say, hey, you know, how's everything going? And mm-hmm. what are you up to? And, you know, what's going on in school? And, is there anything you want to like talk about? And to just get to know, you know, your kids.
Yeah. 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 And that's, you know, it's a far more Asian American household, right? Mm-hmm. Than immigrant household.
Yeah.
And so I think that we will benefit from that, Asian Americans, that the ability to communicate more and to understand the importance of, you know, individual family relationships. You know, we've talked about this with my family. We have a unique situation with my brother being 12 years younger than my sister. Mm-hmm. And so that's 12 years of extra time my parents got to be parents to understand what to do. And so when we get down to my brother and my sister's relationship is completely different than mine and my sister's. It is more of a sibling relationship on equal ground.
Really?
Yes. And I did not know that till I did the conference, because I had him as a panelist, but he told me, or told everyone, that because I was like, you know, mom 2.0 for my sister, more of like helping her and my mom and my parents doing things for her, my brother was simply a brother, you know. Hmm. So he could just talk to my sister on regular sibling things. He was not expected to do anything for her or take care of her. So it became, it was an actual relationship. And then to this day, still, they have an actual sibling relationship. And so I would say I had to work on moving away from being a second mom to a sibling just in the last 5 years. Hmm. And so it's a very interesting dynamic to have that, because my mm-hmm. brother taught me that, you know, like, so 12 years later, like, taught me that there's a different way that you can speak to your sister that doesn't involve all this anger, you know. So that's been very meaningful to our family to be able to do that. But that he is more Asian American and lived in a less immigrant household, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. just from being born 12 years later.
Right. Well, you mentioned to me before that you moved back to DC after being away for 10 years to help your aging parents coordinate services for Jen. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us about that time period and how did you learn how to navigate getting all the services that she needed?
Yeah, so I'm the example, and there's different periods of time of siblings and kind of the parallel experiences we have. This example is of the exhausted parent example the parent is exhausted. The parent feels that maybe their other kid has already gotten the degrees and the work experience and you don't have to worry that much about them anymore, you know, and they really could use some help, you know, mm-hmm. but without actually saying that. Right. And so my sister's life was a series of crises, right? Of just like finishing this program, or, you know, dealing with this emotional outburst, or dealing with, you know, it's just a series of crises where it got to a point where it was just too much for them to handle. And I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and I was basically handling things for them in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I said, you know, it might be time, you know, it might be time. I'm 2 years out of grad school, you know, might be time to go back and just help, you know, help and see what's going on. Help out. The story is my father gave me a box and said, here you go. Dumped in me, and that was his files since she was born, and that was it. he didn't say anything else because they really didn't know, right?
Right.
And so the story was, I went through the box. I knew nothing about it because it's not, my parents did not tell me anything, any programs or supports or anything about her, nothing. So it was just like, here, help us. Thanks. We're really exhausted. And so it was a 4-year process for me to do what we call is navigation, right? So like navigating this system. Mm-hmm. It started off as Googling at 3 a.m. in the morning, how to help my sister with disability. That was mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. And that led to finding sibling resources on the Maryland Developmental Disabilities Council website. Mm-hmm. And I got on that list and stayed on that list for 4 years. But up until that point, it was just like me hitting the ground and just reading relearning what my parents may or may not have known, retracing their steps, going through and saying, okay, making sure there's, you know, what happened here, where, why is there no more funding here? And that took 4 years. And I chose to take a job, to have my own company. So I had the flexibility to go to all the meetings, right. And coordinate all the services and, you know, find a vocational program that will work. She went through like 4, you know, so it was more of a crisis situation where she really needed help and she was angry about it, you know. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't I would say even then, so that's 2011 to 14, it's even better now what kind of resources are out there to be able to do that cold. Uh-huh. But from the experiences I've heard from other siblings, you either are way involved and you know everything down to the medications they take and like what time, mm-hmm. or you know absolutely nothing and you are inundated when they need help or when your parents have passed. Mm-hmm. And so there is a huge gap between right. then of the knowledge. And so what was helpful for me after the 4-year gap, I spent 4 years completely by myself, not knowing that there are even other siblings out there, doing this by myself, spending a lot of time with parents because parents are the ones that really coordinate this care. Uh-huh. And then now afterwards being able to coordinate the sibling conference, uh-huh. realized that it is beyond helpful to be able to say to another sibling, like, hey, eventually you might need to help. Don't worry. You don't need to do it right now. You don't mm-hmm. need to be prepared. There are other siblings that know what you need to do. So don't worry about it.
Right. And it's just interesting, you know, in prior conversations and even just now, just like the perspective of like, what is a sibling? To me, it was always like, okay, a sibling is a brother or sister. And then you think about it and you're like, you know, it really is the sibling is the longest relationship. I mean,
yeah,
right.
It really is. And to think that like, that wasn't really framed that way. You know, uh-huh. growing up or when you give parents resources, you know, when you say like, hey, what should you be focusing on? Hey, how about the kid that's going to be there forever with mm-hmm. your kid, you know? And so we talk about that as a family now and say, you know, that having the sibling is important due to the lifespan, you know, mm-hmm. due to the lifespan, like, and even having different siblings at different ages is so crucial.
Right.
To be able to have the whole life scan covered is kind of like what we want to say is,
right.
you know, she'll be all right anytime in her life, you know.
But I mean, even when you moved back, I mean, there were just, you know, as this, the neurotypical sibling, I mean, you must have felt like you had to put things on hold for yourself, or did mm-hmm. you, I mean, did you feel that way?
Uh-huh. Oh, absolutely. It was about a 6-year delay in my life. If you think about it, because it was 4 years to help, 2 years of like recovering, right? Of just like, well, okay, now what? You know, like this is a mess, and now I still have to coordinate like this going forward. So it took 4 years to get her through a vocational program in order to get a job, right? But then it's like, then you got to help manage through the job, mm-hmm. And so It was like, 6 years. It was extremely stressful. I put everything on hold. So this is family of my own, having more of my own personal life. Mm-hmm. It very much felt like I had adopted a child. And mm-hmm. so I resented my parents, not so much my sister. It was more resented my parents for making it very clear that it was a responsibility of me. Mm-hmm. Right. And that could be cultural. A lot of it is cultural, but yeah. I've heard with other siblings as well. And it depends on that, but it was more of like, this is your responsibility now because we have supported you and let you do whatever you want.
Yeah, I totally get it. That's right. We put you through school so that you could be independent. And right. now you have to take care of everything.
Exactly. It's like we paid for you to do this. You got to live wherever you got to travel. You had a life. Yeah. So now, you know, so yeah. I would say the resentment, right, of the jealousy, not jealousy, but resentment really went to my parents later on in life, mm-hmm. and just like, why are you doing this, you know, kind of situation.
Yeah. And your brother wasn't old enough to take on those responsibilities.
Absolutely. I had resentment towards him. I was like, what, can you just step up, you know? Yeah. Like, can you step up? And being a baby child, if you have three kids, you know, it's like, no, they're always later, and they're later, you know, mm-hmm. in a lot of development things, but also they have a completely different life.
Yes.
And so it's not parallel.
Yeah.
And then we've talked about that at the sibling conference. There's also a different dynamic between brother, sister, you know, brother, sibling relationships, and how that works. So, I was very resentful of my other sibling and my parents for about like 4 years, four or five years. Yeah. Yeah. It was extreme stress. Yeah.
How did you get involved in organizing the conferences? The sibling conferences.
You know, after the 4 years of hustling is what I call it, where I'm like, I just ran around the whole county meeting with every single agency there practically is. Mm-hmm. And then I had taken some time to say, okay, now I would like to take the time I was doing that, and I would like to do what I like, other things. So I'd gotten a part-time job, and on top of the company that I was running. And then, in the middle of the night, I got an email from the Maryland Disabilities Council that there was a sibling coordinator position to run a conference. I didn't know what that meant. And that was the first time I had really seen that there is a sibling thing, you mm-hmm. know? And mm-hmm. so that is, there's nothing more interesting other than like, I saw it and I said, oh my gosh, what I just did in the last 4 or 5 years, I've got to help someone not go through that. You know, like it was like, I was like, this could be an opportunity for me to like actually use all this stuff that I just learned and went through and make sure no one else does that, you know? And I very much felt that way. And then I very much felt that way towards like Asian Americans, because I had not met any Asian Americans along the way. It was, there was no understanding of our culture mm-hmm. and how to provide services that were culturally competent. And so I felt very, very like, this is going to be really easy and fun, because now I can, it was more for like myself. It was let me heal myself, because this was so painful. But now I'm going to pass this on, because I don't want anyone else to do this, because I've just done it. You should, everybody just copy, you know, like,
right.
So that's how I got involved. That was it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned that there were different workshops by lifespan. Mm-hmm. Can you mm-hmm. talk about those different workshops to help give listeners insight into the different sibling issues, like, you know, at each stage?
Yeah. So I really truly credit Brian Cox and Rachel London at Maryland Developmental Disabilities Council for this, and their sibling advisory group that wanted a conference. Is that it seemed so ambitious at the time, and it still was, is that they wanted a conference that was statewide, that covered, from a 5-year-old sibling to an 80-year-old sibling, and mm-hmm. wanted full programming for an 8-hour day, full programming for any age. So mm-hmm. It was quite difficult, the first conference, to coordinate, but then the second one was much easier. But mm-hmm. the first one was because you wanted substantial content, and it really makes a difference it's not so much what age sibling you are as more of like where you are in your sibling lifespan with your sibling. So you could be 80 years old and have never had to do anything for your sibling. You could be 15 years old and you've done everything, you know? So yeah, it was, so we were able to say, it's not age. It's really where you are. And from that, we developed programming that would be, you know, inclusive. So it was very, it was easy for, I think it's elementary school and below. So from like five to like, you know, fifth grade or something, there is already a program called SIB Shops through the Kinderling Institute. Don Mayer, who's the founder of that organization, and SIB Shops was our guest, was our keynote speaker at our first conference. So we had workshops for children with other siblings where you had fun recess kind of activities interspersed with activities that allowed you to maybe share a little bit about the frustrations you're going through. It's a very well designed workshop for small children. And I'd say it's probably the most, it'll be the most beneficial going, you know, going forward, like as you get older, if you're able, you know, to have your sibling coordinate, get involved in this. And that we realized that just having a place for someone to go, you're 6 years old, you know, and your brother has, you know, cerebral palsy, and you don't know what's going on, and no one's paying attention to you, you know, and you're seeing stressed out parents, and you're going to a million doctor's appointments, and you're in hospitals, right? And so we realized this program, when I got trained in it, was just a couple of hours on a Saturday where you just got to hang out as a normal person, a normal kid, and do fun things with other kids, and then you'll learn a little bit about that all these kids around you are dealing with the same thing.
And it's
quite powerful. And so that was new for me because I did not have that when I was little. And so we had that for young kids. And then we had the worst segment ever, which is teenagers, which I spent the most time probably figuring them out and what to do for them. But it was very important as well, you know, it's because teenagers will never be okay no matter what. And then you add on to the level of you have a you know, a sibling with disabilities, it's far more difficult to navigate. But what we have found out is that once you know someone else is a sibling and they're in your school or in a sister school, you're going to be best friends. And I think that was really scary. Like when I saw that, I was like, oh my gosh, you know, it's like teens aren't friends with that, just anyone. But when I saw that, it was like that power of like, we had groups of, you know, teenagers that had looked nothing like each other, and they're immediately friends because it was like, oh shoot, your sister has autism too. Your brother has Asperger's, you know, and that was really all. And you could just vent, you know?
Yeah. Because you just have that connection.
You have
that. You just understand. You're like, you okay.
Yeah. And then we went through, you know, basically like kind of a 20s all the way over 20s, 30s, 40s, all the way over to senior, where in your 20s as a sibling, when you're graduating college and grad school and figuring out your life, what you're doing is trying to incorporate your sibling into your life, into your social life. You're not actually helping them do anything. You just want to include them along the journey. And that's very difficult, usually because you're not living in the same state. And then we went on to maybe 30s or 40s and 50s, where you're full on taking care of everything for your siblings. So it was incredible to have that lifespan all in one room.
You know,
230, you know, siblings that could just being able to see the whole lifespan. We had a panel on it as well to just really understand that this is your life. And it defines you, but it doesn't define you.
Right, right.
You are a sibling last, is what I like to say at the conferences. That you are your own person first. You're a sibling last, and when you grow up, you're always just the other kid, and you don't really have your own identity as anything else. Mm-hmm. And so I think once we got really hit that nerve during the conferences and telling people, like, we're not going to talk about your siblings today. We're going to talk about you. In your life, and what's common about us, which we all find out we have so much in common, so much in common. We are all neurotic overachievers, to quote Don Meyer. We all go into jobs that help people. Mm-hmm. We are extremely empathetic in the workplace and in public. When we can see a family with a kid with disabilities, or if there's discrimination against that kid or the family in public, we know what to do. Yeah. These are things that, if someone didn't tell me that we all did this together and we have this mindset, I would not have known, right? Mm-hmm. The superpower we talked about in the beginning.
And then, so did you guys also talk about, like, in the 20s, I would think, like, 20s, people are thinking about, thinking about marriage, or, you know, definitely dating, marriage, and, like, finding, you know, I would think it's just, you know, would make it harder to find a spouse or your significant other who's accepting of your, the sibling who's not neurotypical, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's like another thing that can make things difficult for the neurotypical child, right?
Yeah. I think what's really fascinating, I also learned getting introduced to the sibling community, is what is a term called sibin law, where it's you have the sibling and their spouse is also affected by all the planning and drama that needs to happen, and so they're their own group. We actually had our own workshop for people who were married to siblings of people with disabilities, you know. And so it's actually pretty amazing when we had a workshop for 20s and 30s, and you have a lot of women like myself that say, we're delaying marriage, we're delaying kids because there's no way we can handle that. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, it was like, you have to be super careful who you spend your time with and who you, you know, decide to spend your life with. They need to understand what your life will be. Surprisingly, when we talk about it, and we get to meet everybody else's significant others and their spouses, you know, that other person is like an angel, right?
Yes.
They if they married you and they knew what you have, your responsibilities are, they're an angel.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
So very few times do we get stories of, you know, a spouse that doesn't care, you know, because we can choose.
Exactly. Yeah.
we can choose.
It's like,
right.
You need to be a patient person.
Yes.
If you want to be with me.
You have to be patient, inclusive, and giving and generous and everything. And so it ends up being actually a very positive thing, but there is a lot of angst in the younger, you know, 20, 30s years of, you know, why am I delaying? I just can't handle it, you know, kind of that. But again, nothing that couldn't have been felt much better just knowing that that's what everyone goes through.
Right.
Know?
Right.
Yeah.
But I guess then there's that added component of, like, you know, feeling guilty. Like, just for me, like, even feeling guilty, like, with my kids, is like, I don't want them to feel like their brother will be a burden to them. So
absolutely.
It's just that passing on, you know, because, you know, we worry about, oh, you know, with not just my oldest, but, like, all
absolutely.
My kids, you obviously want your kids to be able to be independent and be okay when you're no longer around. But just to invite somebody into your family and go, okay, you know, are you going to be okay with this? Because I feel bad that I might have to.
I feel bad, but I don't. Right?
Yeah,
it's like you feel bad, but it's like it's non-negotiable. Actually, you know.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. And what I like about what you said that just remind me is, like, the idea of burden. As I have gotten older, I've realized that it is it has shifted from burden of my sister to burden of my parents. My parents don't want to be a burden to me or my brother yes. as they age, right? Yes. And so now you kind of see the parallels of like, nobody wants to be a burden. It just, you didn't want my sister to be a burden growing up. And now I'm old enough, I can see you don't want to be a burden as you age too. So there's, mm-hmm. there's that. And that only comes with age. You know, yeah. some things only come with age. So I appreciate being able to see that now and saying like, it's either it is a burden or it isn't, but there is definitely a way to get to the point where it's not resentful burden, right?
Right.
It's an understanding. There's a right. way to work it out. There's a lot of things that we can do to make this a positive experience because there's so much right now with sandwich generation, right? Mm-hmm. Taking care of your young kids as well as your parents. So we're being much more open about that.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, it's got to be, I mean, that is so cool that you had the conference because certainly mm-hmm. Different times of the lifespan, then you would also have to think about like, life planning for right. your sibling,
right?
Like, you know, what's going to happen, or like, I don't know, like, do you guys talk about wills and stuff like that? Or
yeah, so we had an Ask a Sibling workshop at the conference. Mm-hmm. So the number one thing that parents say as their long term plan for their children is that they will outlive them. Mm-hmm. So that's actually I don't get that different answer from anyone. I'm like, what is your long-term plan? I'm going to live forever. Cool. All right. You know?
Right.
And that's where my parents are. I've always been. They probably to this day, they're still saying like, no, I'm fine. We're good. You know? Don't worry. I'm going to live forever. I'm never dying. You know? So, not productive as you know, for life planning. So, life planning is a difficult question for anyone. And so you add on to the fact that you need to have this understanding earlier when you have a sibling or a child with disabilities is also really difficult, even more difficult. So my parents said nothing. And when I was doing the conference, I even had like these questions from the National ARC saying, here are the questions you should ask your parents as a sibling about life planning, right? Mm-hmm. And so my brother and I sat down with my parents and read the questions to them. Mm-hmm. And they said, that's great. That's a great resource for people, not us though.
Yeah, I get
like,
it. Yeah.
I'm so glad you're doing this for other people.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Do I? Yeah. Yeah.
Totally understand.
Right. So that also is a very diverse, experiences from siblings. You have siblings that are massively involved. We have some siblings that are actually sit in the IEP meetings.
Wow.
You know, uh-huh. You know, and then actually help manage, you know, the actual care. And then you have siblings like me where it's like me and my brother are planning on the side what to do. And I wouldn't have been able to do it myself. I had to be able to do it with my brother when he was old enough. And like, here's what we're going to plan on the side. And hey, by the way, we'll just let them know. We'll let our parents know. And they just kind of like quietly, like, cool, that sounds great. Okay, mm-hmm. great. You know? Yeah, yeah. But life planning is not something that I know, especially in some cultures, in American as well, is that, you know, it's okay. You can talk about it. Everybody needs a will. You know, there's important things to do, you know.
Yeah.
And other families, you're never going to talk about it.
Right.
You know?
No,
and
I know. Yeah.
And it should be okay. Like, and that's the problem. There's a lot of judgment when it comes, like some siblings get very, very, very angry, which I understand when their parents pass or unexpectedly pass and they're thrown into this world of care and wills. So yes, but I also don't think that's something specific to having a child with disabilities. Mm-hmm. That's anybody. That's life, you know?
Yeah.
So. Mm-hmm.
Did you have a lot of individuals or siblings who were much older, older than you and I, because their experiences must have been different because their siblings were probably institutionalized and they probably don't, maybe they, I don't know, maybe just don't trust the system as much or.
Absolutely. We had an entire group, many, many, many siblings that we call, I guess, like retirement phase or, you know, so it's like 70 and above, like we go up to like maybe like 93. We had someone who's 93. Every single one of their siblings were institutionalized. Every single one of them were also white. And so like, it's their own world where they have horror stories of their siblings being, abused or taken advantage of in institutions, they are extremely grateful and very appreciative of having, especially this conference, or being able to speak to younger siblings, to be able to say, to feel like this is not going to happen to you because of what the work that you're doing, like what we do in our partners in policymaking class, because of the work that people are doing, we no longer have institutions and you will no longer have to deal with those. And so they talk with each other about all the legal battles that they have to deal with in terms of abuse, because that's what it was back then. And and in terms of silent generation, that is a generation that never even acknowledged your sibling in an institution. So when they're at the conference, it's amazing because they can just very clearly look out there and say, things have changed and you feel good about it because you fought also to, for that. And it just took a really long time, you know? Mm-hmm. So I love talking to them because to anyone who's over 70, really, because they just tell you, they tell you what to do in life. They say, here, don't do this and do this.
Right.
And if you listen, far, far less stress, but they're my favorite group to talk to because their perspective is so different.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. What's your relationship like with Jennifer now?
After many years, actually through this conference as well, my sister and I are actually not just sisters, we're actually best friends. So if you want to, you can be best friends with your own sister when you're in your 40s. Let me just tell you that. The quarantine also brought us even closer. We were already close following my work with, you know, the sibling conference, as well as, you know, just working through my own personal life in dealing with the stress of helping her. So understanding that I don't have to be mom 2.0, I can be sister. I can be a sister. Mm-hmm. And so that's only happened in the last couple of years, actually with a lot of encouragement from my younger brother and my boyfriend, my current boyfriend. It's just understanding, like, so much can change if you just speak to someone differently, like they're actually equal and not like, you know, someone that needs your help constantly.
Right.
And so that has been a multi-year process. I'd say about 3 years now. Most frequently, like I said, in my 40s and 30s, and now we are absolute best friends. Do everything together every single day. This quarantine has been a complete disaster for her mentally. And so it's been super crucial that I, you know, spend time with her and create experiences for her, but I actually want to. There's no obligation. There's no feeling of responsibility. That took 40 years to get to that point. But I don't think I could have been there earlier. You know.
Mm-hmm. Does Jennifer, is she living independently, and is she working?
So she's living with my parents. Mm-hmm. She has always lived with my parents. This was actually a decision because they were scared into, like, back when she was in elementary school, when she was recommended to be put into an institution, and they went to visit it and they just freaked out. So since then they were like, she's never gonna live anywhere other than like it safely in our house. So she of course wants to have her own place. And we actually through many, many years have trying to wean my parents off the idea that like she can do it. You just got to give her a lot of time to learn. And so we are working on independent living skills, like, you know, grocery shopping, understanding bills a little bit. I mean, it's hard. But the way that I've looked at it is, you know, if you give her a timeline of 100 tries to get it right, we're still learning, you know. So there is no timeline or what age that she needs to learn what she wants to learn, you know? So, yeah. So I think, our goal really, I've talked to my sister about it, is like, hey, we're talking like, you know, 10 more years, you know, you 100% live on your own, do everything by yourself. So let's start now. Let's learn now.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I'm positive she'll get there.
I mean, I think it's just, different to being the sibling. It's probably easier for you. Your perspective is different from the parent in the sense that, like for me before, like drive, when my son was learning to drive, or if he wanted to go someplace, I'd be like, I don't know. But then it's easier for the sibling to say, why not? It's fine. you know, let them if they want to,
exactly,
kind of a thing, right? And I think you know we kind of talked about a little bit of about stuff like that before in our partners in policy making class, where it's like that, you know, as a sibling, you can talk to the parents, say, hey, let them try it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that's your job. Your job is to never let them do anything. Your job is to protect. You or protect them and never let them out of the house. I wouldn't want you to do anything different, you know? And I think realizing now it's like, it's a sibling's job to be like, hey, I want my sibling to be treated like you treat me. And that's it. Like you let me do and you let me mess up. And sometimes you don't let me mess up, but whatever. Would you change the way, you know, you parented me? I'm like, no, even though I would change the way you parented me, you know, but so I think that dynamic is pretty powerful in knowing that, you know, that's really where you think about being an advocate, right? Being a sister, being a sibling.
Mm-hmm.
And then what I'm learning now through all the new material and our program as well, is like shifting from advocating to teaching my sister how to be a self-advocate.
Yeah.
And so that's a longer process. And it's, I think it's much harder for a parent to do with their child. And I don't think there should be that expectation.
Mm-hmm. What are your hopes and fears for Jennifer?
Ooh. Yeah. I read this question. I was like, I'm going to do this. I'm trying to do this without crying. So let me start with fears. It's because it's simple. We've done this on many sibling panels. The fear for my sister is that she will be alone, mm-hmm. that she will feel lonely. She will not know who to talk to or to reach out to. We all actually say that. We actually, when we get down to it, I've been on many panels, and we're all afraid of, because we know that when you wake up in the morning, more days than others, our siblings are going to feel like they're by themselves, and that no one's out there for them. So that's my biggest fear. And so I don't know if I can fix that, you know, but I know that, I think that's a lot of people's fears too. So that makes me feel better that, you know, like working on my sister's mental health and, dealing with being alone will be helpful. So, but that's definitely my biggest fear for her, that she just won't feel like she has someone there. Okay. So hopes. I know, right? Are we like completely like crying?
I know. Me too.
Cause that's real. Like you really, like I'll tell you what makes me cry during this quarantine, which is that I was talking to my boyfriend. I was saying, like, you know, the thought that my sister has absolutely nobody to see or hang out with, or she cannot see her friends, and it's been, you know, like seven months,
mm-hmm.
like absolutely breaks my heart, you know, it breaks my heart. Of like, couldn't you imagine if you were not allowed to see like anybody, you know? And that is my sister, that is her friends, you know, those are her friends that are, you know, banned from leaving their house, you know. I'm like, can you imagine the mental anguish that is going on that you just don't know about, you know? So that's really enlightened me. And of course there's ways to remedy it, but the acknowledgement that is our biggest fear for sure. And then that gives me solace when I think about my brother and have, you know, and just being her sibling, is that, well, she's never gonna be alone, and I can tell her that, you know. So that helps. My hope for her, honestly, is that she gets everything she wants. I think it's taken her this time to give, because our family have not allowed her to have her own brain, her own thoughts, her own opinion. We haven't allowed her to fail, make mistakes. We've tried to manage her life so that she does not have to feel any type of pain or hurt, you know, from the real world. And I think now we're saying, hey, you got to let her, you know, develop who she thinks she is. And you have to be okay with it. And that's probably my biggest lesson from my parents. And it's working very slowly, where I've said, hey, you know, if she wants to do this, if she wants to wear this, let her do it, stop, you know, like it's hard for a mom. I understand, like, my sister, she wears, her thing is like she wears two different socks And they're always like, you know, with like the cool, like, you know, like donuts on one or avocados on it. She loves it. She loves it. And my thought has always been that she wears two different socks because it was probably really hard for her to find the other sock. You know? So I feel like she wears, you know, she wears both of them and she loves it and it's her thing, you know, mm-hmm. And my mom will get really upset and be like, it doesn't match, you know, whatever. But it's like, so when you see like someone trying to express themselves, and you're trying to express themselves in a very like different way than you, mm-hmm. you know, to really like learn how to acknowledge that and then like foster it. So I hope that she can continue to do that and to find things that really like she knows makes her happy. Like that makes her happy. Jewelry makes her happy. You know, very specific things make her happy, and that knowing that and being able that she knows herself more, that's my hope for her, that she knows who she is and she's not afraid of it. And she doesn't care. She already doesn't care so much about what people think. It's taken a while. I give her a lot of credit. My sister just is not afraid to eat by herself, to go to the mall by herself, to be on the bus by herself. She feels very free. Mm-hmm. So my hope for her is that she finds that freedom and peace. Mm-hmm. That she is accepted, you know,
right,
she's accepted right. by in this world and by the people around her.
Right. How has being a sibling changed you?
Yeah. Okay. Again, trying not to cry. So I think I am blessed. I think it is probably the most important defining thing for me as a person is to be my sister's sister. I don't think there's anything I've done in my life that is more important than to learn from her. She's the reason why I am so successful, so smart, so understanding of other people. She's the reason why I don't give up. Mm-hmm. Because when you see someone, we all know this, like someone who has developmental disabilities, they, you know, God is fair. Like they take like the mean bone out of them, right? It's like, there's no mean gene or not like horrible person gene in a person who has right. disability, right?
Right.
Like
right.
There's no dishonesty. There's no, you know, there's
yeah.
none of that.
Yeah.
They're a pure person. And so to be able to share my life with someone who has an absolute purest point of view of what the life should be like and what we should all be entitled to has shaped who I am. She works harder than anybody I know. She believes in herself more than anybody I know. And it's made me not only work a hell of a lot harder, you know, to do everything that I've done, but also to really, really understand how lucky I am. Mm-hmm. And I think through this sibling experience, I've realized that we are all really lucky and we kind of know it. You know, when you start talking to other siblings, sharing your horror stories, you know, mm-hmm. In the end, you're like, but I'm really good as in this world, my yeah. trajectory, my life as a person, I am really good because of my sister. And because no one had to teach me, you know, it's just like mm-hmm. just being able to see that, like, I feel I have an advantage, you know, like yeah. I do, I feel like I have an advantage, like, you know, that I get something that you don't quite get. And so there's nothing I'm more proud of, to tell you the truth. She is she's my role model. She's my hero. She's really the reason why our family is probably still together, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Look what I made you do. Look what I made you do.
Oh,
I know, right? Crap. Okay.
Carolyn, what words of wisdom would you like to share with us, and especially for the neurotypical siblings?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is also really, took me a while to figure this out, but I've got this figured out because I've been asked that so many times. My words of wisdom would be, change your expectations. Change your expectations. You are wrong. Whatever you think your sibling can do, you're wrong. They can do 100 times more. You need to be the one who says that, and you need to be the one that knows that, because I've seen it, right? I've seen mm-hmm. it. I didn't know that before. I was like, oh, she's only going to be able to do this, and she's only going to be able to do this, and I've got to help her. But now I know that that we're wrong. Like, that is probably my biggest words of wisdom, is that you are wrong. You are wrong about what they can do. You are wrong about who they are. You are wrong that you know them. They are far more beautiful than you. They're far more successful than you. And if you don't know that now, you'll know that later, which is okay. Mm-hmm. And then you can foster it correctly. And I think that's what has made my life so fulfilling, is that, you know, like, you know, this idea of like getting a degree, like getting an example, right? Like, my sister has a high school diploma, doesn't have a college degree, and she's always wondered why she couldn't get one, you know, because mm-hmm. she wasn't able to get to pass the assessment test. And then I just thought, you know, you can get a degree any time you want, right? It's like, it's like, you can have it anytime you want. Just because you're like Asian and you don't get it like in a, you know, perfectly, like your other two siblings, doesn't matter. And so I'm able to say to her, like, you can take as long as you want, you know, like, I don't care what anybody else says, right? I don't care what anybody else says about, like, you're supposed to have a job, you're supposed to do this, you're supposed to do that. It's like, yeah, you know that, and you can take as long as you can. And I think, one, knowing that I'm wrong, two, changing my expectations, and three, extending the timeline for infinity, saying that, hey, it took me 5 minutes to figure this out. If it takes you 5 years, that is fine. Mm-hmm. You know, that is fine. And that kind of changes the expectation of my parents and of society, right? Of just saying, like, hey, yeah, you're on your way, but someone's on another way. And you don't get to judge that. You know, one of the things I've said, and I hope, I don't know when this will catch on, I do hope it does, is when people ask, like, you know, what's wrong with her? Like, what's her disability? And I'll say, like, she doesn't have one. I don't know what you're talking about. Like, I'll be like, she is a person. She's similar to you, and then she's different from you. And that's it. You know, I feel like once we label these things, we say you're less than someone. Mm-hmm. You know, why does she have a disability and I don't? I think I have lots of disabilities. You know, like, I think I have a lot of things that hold me back. You know, so I think my wish is that maybe the siblings, we can push for that. It's like, they're not any different than us, and we know that. There's no special treatment, and don't feel bad for me. You know, I think that's another thing. Like, growing up, people feel like, oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Your sister has a disability. And I'm like, I didn't know what that meant. And now I'm like, hey, first of all, I'm lucky. Number two, she doesn't have a disability. She's totally fine. Like, she'll ask me, like, people ask me what my disability is. What do I say? I go, you tell them you don't have one, because we need to stop labeling people, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that's been the most powerful and life-changing in terms of trying to educate, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, that concludes our podcast for today. Thank you, Carolyn, for sharing your story and knowledge to help educate and empower us. We wish you and your family all the very best. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. Stay well, and I will talk to you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Autism Mom MD podcast. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend, spread the word, and leave a review on iTunes. For any questions, comments, or suggestions for topics you'd like to hear on the podcast, please join our Facebook group, Autism Mom MD, or visit us on the web at www.autismmommd.com.